Beetroot juice, used by Olympic athletes for its stamina-boosting effects, caused waves at the last Olympics. Clinical studies proved 2 glasses of beetroot juice per day could increase stamina by 16%. I've been using it, and this product is excellent. Beets are a nutrition goldmine, so call 800-738-2198 or go to intelligentbeets.com. Get a 30-day supply free. That's 800-738-2198 or intelligentbeets.com. Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. This is part two of today's Q&A with Layla. This is an edition of Intelligent Medicine we do each week wherein we answer your questions. You can send questions to radioprogram@AOL.com. Radioprogram@AOL.com. And so what's our next question, please?
Okay, our next question comes from Michael. Hello, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. Could you talk about the causes of irritable bowel syndrome and its treatments? Thank you, and continue your dissemination of helpful information to the public. Thank you very much.
Oh, that's very kind.
Nice,
okay.
Michael.
So, yeah. Wow, this could be quite a dissertation.
That's actually a clinical-focused podcast.
Yeah. And I don't think we have done that, but I will refer, Michael, is it?
Yes.
To a recent podcast that we did with a naturopathic physician, Benjamin, I'll have to look up his last name. He has an excellent book on digestive wellness, and we just did it a couple of weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
The book is all about irritable bowel syndrome. So I recommend that book very highly because it's one of the clearest, most scientifically based books about irritable bowel syndrome and its natural care.
Do you think it's still a diagnosis of exclusion?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. It's a wastebasket diagnosis.
Right.
So anytime you have digestive problems and it's not ulcerative colitis, not Crohn's disease, it's not an ulcer, it's not, GERD, it's not any of the entities which respond well to medication, then you have, by exclusion, irritable bowel syndrome. But they divide it into subcategories. You go to IBSD, which is irritable bowel syndrome characterized by diarrhea. You go to IBSC,
yeah,
which is irritable bowel syndrome characterized by constipation. Sometimes you have a mixed picture where sometimes you're constipated, sometimes you have diarrhea. Some patients report bloating. Some patients report spasm.
And we're finding out that it may be related to SIBO to some degree, which is small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. We're seeing more and more of that, especially with the increased use of PPIs, of Nexium and things for GERD and reflux.
Mm-hmm.
But it could also be related to Candida, which is also kind of SIBO. It's still about dysbiosis. It's still about bad bacteria in the gut.
So,
and, yeah.
Go ahead. So there's also this thing called visceral hypersensitivity or visceral hypervigilance, hyperattention, where some people are just wired to be more attuned to the rumblings and gurglings in their intestinal tract. And it doesn't mean they're nuts. It doesn't mean that they have a psychiatric problem. It's just that constitutional characteristic. Some people are kind of oblivious to what's going on from the neck down, and some people are wired in such a way that they're very, very attuned to the sensations which are going on while you're digesting and peristalsing and
Do you think it's a lack of serotonin
for those people?
100%,
because one of the drugs that unfortunately had to be withdrawn from the market was a serotonin drug. Very much, sort of like like an antidepressant for the intestinal tract. But unfortunately, it had bad side effects, had to be taken off the market. It was a godsend for some people with IBS. But
it's on the tip of my tongue, the name of that. Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was mostly for female IBS. But
I think it started with an R. Okay.
Yeah, it was a funny name, but we'll come back to that.
Anyway, I don't think people know that about as much as 90% of serotonin is in the gut.
Mm-hmm.
The original brain, so to speak.
Right.
The gut brain. So a lot of that has to do with neurotransmitters.
Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that happens is we see often a post-infectious cause, so that people will get, you know, food poisoning. And then they never had IBS ever before. And after the food poisoning, everything changes. And what may happen then is either the nerves become hypersensitized or the tissue becomes, there's an aftermath of inflammation, which makes it much more sensitive to the passage of food contents. So that's called the post-infectious IBS. And it can last not just for a few days or weeks, but it can last for years. It can be permanent. Another cause, you know, parasites could have to be rolled out.
What about antibiotic use?
For sure, absolutely.
Yeah, because that could create dysbiosis.
It absolutely creates. And who is exempt from using antibiotics in this society? All of us virtually take antibiotics. Also, antibiotics are in our foods, inadvertently in our water supply. So we're all getting them. So there's a multiplicity of causes. You know, the food allergy, of course, a fairly high percentage of our patients have problems with one or another food. By eliminating one or another food, they have relief. There's also, you don't necessarily have a food allergy. You could also have an intolerance to a food that's based on how your intestinal flora reacts to the food. So that if you take a lot of sugar, for example, it's not an allergy to sugar, but you cause your intestinal flora to proliferate in a bad way. It's like, you know, weeds will grow in your intestinal tract. If you eat, also junk food, you know, junk food itself.
I can't tell you how many of our patients, just with the elimination of wheat, it doesn't even have to be gluten.
Yep.
It could just be wheat. And suddenly their IBS is 80% better, which is remarkable.
Yep.
But, yeah, it doesn't have to be a wheat allergy. Like you said, it doesn't have to be any of that. Some foods cause people's bowel function to change, to either become more sluggish or cause diarrhea. And then probiotics are really a godsend, because just re-inoculating the gut, just introducing some beneficial bacteria, can turn a lot of people around. Right. I've heard of so many people with the constipation form of irritable bowel syndrome who were taking heroic amounts of fiber, but with no relief.
They just get
no
blown. They get blown up. They feel like they're stuffed with fiber.
They get blown up, exactly. But then they take a probiotic, and voila.
Yeah.
Everything is better. Everything's running.
And a little tip on natural treatments for IBS-C constipation is that kiwis contain a natural substance that is mildly laxative, but they also contain prebiotics, which help foster the growth of good bacteria. And, you know, this is the product we use is called
Flowe,
which is pronounced, I hear Flow, P-H-L-O-E, but it's a product that comes from New Zealand, where they actually call themselves Kiwis down there. That's the national nickname. And Kiwis originated from New Zealand. So this is a product that's manufactured there, and it's very helpful for IBSD. And then taking magnesium citrate also, and titrating it up to a proper dose can be helpful for that. I mean, we could go on, and different strokes for different folks. Oh, and I'll mention this too, and this is important to note, is that when you have IBS, they generally, you know, if you have bad intestinal issues, they'll sometimes do a colonoscopy and they'll say, yeah, you're fine. You don't have colitis. Thank God. You don't have Crohn's disease. Thank God. You just have IBS. But, you know, God and nature didn't put a Berlin Wall between full-blown IBD, which is Crohn's or ulcerative colitis, and IBS. Now the theory is that some people with IBS actually have mild colitis. And that there's actually, if you biopsy the tissue, look very careful, you'll see a high number of white blood cells, inflammatory changes deep within the mucosa. And you'll also, if we do a test for leaky gut syndrome, you'll see changes in intestinal permeability in the IBS patients. And so sometimes by treating, like we might treat colitis, using anti-inflammatory agents, using specific carbohydrate diet or a FODMAPs diet, we can turn that around.
Yeah. And we've seen quite a bit of that. So, Okay, Michael, hopefully that all helps you out.
Yeah, I mean, just an introduction. And I'm going to, you know, you ask your next question, because I'm going to just look up the name of the podcast that was.
Okay. All right. This one comes from Kathy. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, hello, this is Kathy again. Thank you for answering my question in January on estrogen dominance. My headaches are much better. Thank you for improving my life quality.
That's great.
That's very nice. I would like to ask a question about my 80-year-old father. He has numbness in both of his legs, and the MRI results showed moderate spinal stenosis, L3 and 4, and recently he had his first epidural steroid injection. Are there any supplements that can help him reduce the pain and numbness? Are there exercises that might help? This is a consultation.
Yeah, well, you know, I got to say that I kind of hate questions about spinal stenosis, because spinal stenosis means a compression of the spinal cord that occurs usually as people age. And once that occurs, it's very hard to treat. And I can't make a claim that supplements help that. You know, maybe sometimes, you know, a B12 shot can help, sometimes help nerve conduction. Alpha-lipoic acid sometimes helps neuropathy, but probably not where there's compression of the spine. So when you have spinal stenosis, usually you have more trouble initiating walking, and once you get going, you feel better. And that's kind of the opposite of claudication, where you have, you're okay starting, but then, you know, with exertion, you find that your legs become weak and painful. It's a really serious problem. I think what we've got to do is, you know, just like we do cardiovascular prevention, and we're starting to do diabetes prevention, we're starting to do stroke prevention, and, you know, all these cancer prevention, we need to do back prevention. And that starts early in life. We've got to get people on proper stretching regimens. Anti-inflammatory diets help, avoidance of overweight.
What do you think of that contraption that people lie down on and goes upside down?
Oh, the inversion?
Like decompressed the, I don't know what it's called.
I think it's fine, but, you know, I think it's possibly dangerous for people who have stroke risk, or have, you know, increased intraocular pressure, or the potential to have an eye hemorrhage, because you're putting a lot of pressure on those blood vessels. I work out in the gym, and I see there's some fantastic seniors working out at my YMCA, and I see there's like a 75-year-old woman who's doing like headstands, and she does them for like minutes at a time. God bless her. She's in excellent physical condition. But, you know, another person who just tries to do it, you know, after a lifetime of, you know, sedentary activity and in poor physical shape, they might, you know, they might be at risk. So yeah. Benjamin Brown is the name of the guy who did the IBS podcast. That was on May 5th, 2015. So if you go to drhoffman.com and look it up and get the book. The book is called The Digestive Health Solution, Your Personalized 5-Step Plan for Inside-Out Digestive Wellness. And, you know, I just picked out that book among, you know, I get so many books here that, you know, I give away a lot of my, there practically could be a wing at the public library that's the Ronald Hoffman Memorial Wing, you know, of donated books that I never talk about on the air because they just don't pass muster. There's so many health books, you know, publicists send me them. But this one caught my eye. So this guy, very sensible guy. I tracked him down in England, and we interviewed him in London. And I didn't go there, unfortunately. I didn't get to go.
Next time.
That'd be a good excuse, though. I'd like to go. But we did it on the phone. He just makes a lot of sense. So here's another one. I know we're jumping around here, so please bear with me. But he makes a lot of melatonin for IBS, and there really is something to it, is that melatonin may have a calmative effect for many patients with IBS. And you don't need to take, 50 milligrams. You can take the ordinary sleep dosage, which is 3 or 5 milligrams, and you can get a calming of your IBS, particularly if it bothers you at night. So,
is he recommending taking melatonin during the day for this?
No, at night. Because otherwise you'll mess up your circadian rhythm. But, you know, other things that are helpful, enteric-coated peppermint, carminative herbs, kiwi extract, probiotics, digestive enzymes, hydrochloric acid. He talks about all those.
Yeah. So. Yep. Magnesium citrate. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Okay. Thank you, Kathy. And let's see here.
Did we answer Kathy's question? Did we get diverted?
Yeah. Well, it was about the stenosis. So.
Right. Yeah. No. I hate it when people confront me with that, because once you're there, it's very hard to reverse. And, you know, the exercises and physical therapy really make sense, and you really have to stick to it, because you can unlimber your, even if you have spinal stenosis, you can often partially unlimber your spine by beginning the right kind of physical therapy.
Best of luck to Kathy's father.
You know, these injections, these you often do steroid injections in the spine. They are, according to recent studies, by and large not helpful. Spinal surgery, sometimes helpful, but very iffy. Not sometimes totally ineffective and risky. So that's why I really argue for prevention of that. So do your yoga, do your stretching, you know, keep your spine limber and supple. And don't eat a pro-inflammatory diet. And take lots of fish oil, which will lubricate your spinal joints.
Yeah, that's good advice. Okay. Best of luck to Kathy's dad.
Yep.
All right.
What's our next question, Leila?
Our next question comes from Danita. Danita says, I'm a long-term user of olive leaf, about 13 years, because of unknown viruses and other reasons. Anyway, now I have problems with gut flora, finding that some probiotics are non-existent in my gut and we've not been able to regrow it. Do you think I should stop taking the olive leaf? Do you think this is why?
Okay, so this is a problem that we see from time to time. We actually do something called a comprehensive digestive and stool analysis, or a CDSA, on patients who have gastrointestinal problems. And sometimes we'll find, lo and behold, they're taking tons of probiotics, and yet they have zero lactobacillus growth in their stool. And you've seen these profiles as well, Leila. And so it mystifies us. You know, how come you can be taking tons of probiotics, but nothing is taking hold? And this is what this listener is referring to. So it appears that the answer lies somewhere along the lines of, you know, what happens when you spread seeds into a desert and the seeds, you know, should grow, but they don't grow because the conditions are not right for their growth. And for one reason or another, it could be because of improper diet, or it could be because of the presence of competing bugs that may crowd out the beneficial bacteria. So sometimes it's necessary to eradicate the harmful bugs. And we can try eradicating them with natural things like olive leaf extract, or we now have products like Candibactin. AR and BR. That's something available at drhoffman.com. It's a combination of herbs, biocidin. You know, it's unlikely that the olive leaf is preventing the good bacteria from growing. It's usually pretty selective and goes after more the bad bacteria than the good bacteria. So in some cases, we have to identify the harmful bacteria and use an antibiotic, an actual prescription antibiotic to get rid of things. Or possibly there's yeast, and we have to use prescription antifungals to get rid of the yeast. And that will change the environment, change the pH of the intestinal tract, and that can make a difference.
Wow. So, okay. Danita, thank you for your question. All right. Do we have time for another?
Yes, we do.
Great. This comes from Bob. Dr. Hoffman and Leila, is extreme foaming or bubbling in the urine cause for alarm? I'm 79 years old, and I have no other related symptoms.
Oh, that's interesting. You know, you probably you're having too much of that German beer. I think that's what the problem is. Because, you know, there's a, this reminds me of a funny story, is I was in Germany, and this many years ago, and I was in a small town in Germany, and it was middle of the afternoon, and I said to my traveling companion, I said, let's go get a beer. And so we walked into this German bar, and you know, it was a real traditional German bar, and nobody was in there. I guess it wasn't drinking hour. And what were these two Americans stumbling in there? And I said, I know some Germans, so I said to the bartender, I said, ein Pils, bitte. And a Pils is a name for a Pilsner. It's a type of beer. And then I sat down, and I started talking to my travel companion. And the guy... You know, and we were waiting for my beer. And I'm thinking, you know, all kinds of paranoid fantasies crossed my mind. They thought, like, you know, they don't like Americans. They didn't understand me. You know, what's the deal here? You know, so like 10, 15 minutes pass. And I finally get up and I go to the bar and I said, "Where is my pills, please, bitte?" And the guy points to it and it's sitting on the counter. And it's sitting on the counter. So like, okay, well, then I reach for it. He goes, no. He prevents me from getting my pills. Apparently, the right way to drink pills is they pour it, and there's a big head of foam. And you have to wait until the foam descends to a certain level.
A pint of Guinness or something.
I think that's like a hardcore way to drink beer.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, excuse me for that totally irrelevant. So I thought I was being victimized by anti-American sentiment, and it was no. I just didn't get it about pills, beer. Okay, so all kidding aside, what causes urine to foam? Well, usually the presence of protein in the urine can cause the urine to foam. So I would suggest a urinalysis or even a 24-hour urine, because it might be a sign of a condition, or it might not be. You know, it might be just a benign manifestation. But, you know, the concern is, does it mean that there's excess protein in the urine, which could be revealed by either a spot urinalysis, just a random sample, or it could be revealed by a 24-hour collection where they quantitate the amount of protein that's leaking from the kidneys. That's called proteinuria. And proteinuria occurs when, you know, your kidneys are not in great shape, due to sometimes high blood pressure or simultaneously high blood pressure and diabetes. That'll do it. And we actually do a test for urinary microglobulin, which is a way to spot the presence of small amounts of protein in the urine that are indicative of strain on the kidney. And we just saw a patient the other day. You know, his blood pressure is a little borderline. He's a little overweight. His blood sugar is a little elevated. And so we did a test to see, is it consequential? Is it having an impact on his kidneys? And it turns out, yes. And we're going to have to urge him to more stringent dietary exercise efforts, or else we're going to have to put him on medication to make sure that his kidneys don't sustain permanent damage from that.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. So, Bob, either give up the beer or, no, even if you don't give up the beer, go get a urine analysis. Wow.
Right.
That's interesting.
Okay. So that's all the time that we have for today's edition of Intelligent Medicine. Thank you very much, Layla. And a reminder that we've got a seminar coming up.
Yes.
It's on June 24th, so save the date and check out our website for an opportunity to view the seminar. We're going to record it, and you know, it's going to be great. The subject is, once again?
Is the end of overeating and food addiction.
Should be great. Yeah. Thank you very much for joining us today, Layla.
Thank you, Dr. Hoffman.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.